Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Everyone, welcome back to the show. As always, I want to note that you can support The Realignment's expanded coverage at realignment.supercast.com. You could also click the link at the top of the show notes. $5 a month, $50 a year, $500 for a lifetime membership. We're also particularly excited to start our exclusive content this upcoming week, so lots of great stuff are coming down the line. It's so important that you help support our work, especially because we're expanding our content and not just putting it all behind a paywall, which especially as the economic times are getting difficult, are going to be difficult for a lot of the people, especially younger listeners, to actually subscribe to. So would love for anyone who believes in our show's mission to support our work there. Now, on to today's episode. Today's topic is the Senate and why it feels like the Senate doesn't function as an institution able to confront the country's problems in a way that it used to in the past. I recorded this before the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, and obviously the Democratic or left-leaning parts, or even some of the center parts of the audience, have been thinking to themselves, why can't the Senate do anything about the issue of gun control and gun violence in the country? If you're to the right, you likely aren't thinking about the issue the same way, but I could guarantee you that there are plenty of other issues, whether it's the regulation of big tech, immigration, / the border wall, where you feel like the Senate is not able to accomplish what you actually want it to accomplish and is instead either not working or is giving its power to other competing types of government, whether it's the courts or the executive branch. Either way, lots to critique here, which is why the guest today, Ira Shapiro, is the perfect one to discuss this with. Ira's written three different books on the Senate: Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. And he's just released The Betrayal, How Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans Abandoned America. He previously worked in the Senate for 12 years and worked in the Clinton White House as chief trade negotiator with Japan and Canada at the rank of ambassador. Obviously, the book's title, with its reference to Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans, is pretty partisan. Ira's pretty upfront with that. But at the same time, we're able to take a big picture conversation that will leave plenty to work with across the aisle of our show's listenership. So I appreciate all of that. So hope you enjoy this episode and would really appreciate if you could give us a shout out in terms of what we should talk about when we just record a discussion episode that's going to air tomorrow. So you could check out our Substack at realignment.substack.com, or you could email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com. With all that said, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Hope you enjoy this conversation and get something useful from it as we struggle to figure out what's coming next. Ira Shapiro, welcome to The Realignment.
Marshall, I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks so much for the chance.
Of course, this is a very obvious, but also a very deep topic. So let's start with a basic civics question, and then we'll expand to get deeper from there. What exactly is the purpose and function of the Senate?
Well, that's a good place to start. When the Constitution was framed, as many know, there was a great debate about whether to have it two houses of Congress or even one, and what the role of two houses would be. And ultimately, of course, the framers came up with the House of Representatives allocated on a population basis and the Senate. And the political compromise of the Senate was that there would be two senators from each state, irrespective of population. But the other part of it was that the framers wanted a strong Senate. And interestingly, that had to do with their ambivalence about an executive branch. They thought they needed a president who was strong because the Articles of Confederation had failed and wasn't strong enough federal government. But at the same time, they feared, having liberated themselves from a monarch, they feared the possibility of an overreaching executive. Their answer, as many of us know, and we learned in civics, was a system based on checks and balances, with Congress being the Article I branch, and particularly, in my view, particularly the strong Senate. the strongest upper house in the world. And the underlying thinking was the Senate has many responsibilities, but checking the president, who might overreach, was really the raison d'etre, the fundamental responsibility.
And to get to something obvious, it seems like, and this is something the founding fathers warned about, obviously, it seems like the big, not flaw in the system, because it's acknowledged, is political parties and partisanship effectively short circuit a lot of the framework you're talking about. So how is just the idea of partisanship played into diminishing a strong Senate?
As you say, Marshall, originally, the Constitution predated political parties. The founders feared factions. They didn't really like the idea of political parties. And they came up with George Washington to be president, who was sort of above the notion of political parties. That lasted exactly as long as Washington did, right? By the time the next president came, we had an intense political situation between the Federalists and the Democrats, Adams versus Jefferson. And so the challenge was, can you make this system work? A non-parliamentary democracy, basically. There aren't very many of them in the world. And the possibilities for deadlock and paralysis are quite significant. And over time, that has proven to be the case. And so we see these periods of great activity by the federal government only periodically, not too many times. And my first book, which was entitled The Last Great Senate, I focused on a Senate that worked with great energy and worked with presidents where possible, held them accountable where necessary. The thing kind of worked out the way it was supposed to. And I said, well, that last great Senate might be the only great Senate. So it doesn't work that often. So the question is what we're experiencing now normal, sort of a reversion to normal, or is it something other than that?
Yeah, there's a million things I want to unpack there. So the first one would be, to your point, most democratic systems didn't follow our exact model of the House and Senate, their parlamentary systems. Was that just a lot of these countries were Anglo, or colonial, so they followed the British tradition? Or was that this idea that maybe this wasn't quite the right way to set this up? Like, why did we end up with such a skewed balance?
I think a little of both. I mean, I think the parliamentary systems are better known around the world. And there was some concern about how the system would work out, our system would work out. I guess I haven't, and I may be guilty of not thinking about it enough. I've been too immersed in our system. But I think both of those factors played into it.
Well, you've written 3 books on the topic, so I don't think anyone's going to accuse you of not thinking enough about anything related to this. But
well, they'll accuse me of not thinking about anything but the modern U.S. Senate sometimes.
Yeah, and this is a related question. I want to push you on your use of the framing of the Senate working during this great era in the 60s and 70s. So I want to actually get you to describe this period, because I was looking at the jacket of your previous book on how the Senate was broken. And in the book, you talk about these examples of the Senate working. So civil rights legislation, Watergate, checking Vietnam, all these different bits, all these, post-60s reforms. Let's put aside civil rights for a second, because that's obviously a very, very specific issue there. But even looking at the Great Society reforms, those are all center-left to liberal to progressive accomplishments. So I worry when we define the Senate as working and very clearly juxtaposing it in a position of liberal dominance in the country, it's going to make anyone to the right of center say, wait, why would I want the Senate to work? Your definition of the Senate working is just your side getting what it wants. So how do you think about that frame?
I think that's a very good kind of question to grapple with, to check one's biases in these things. And certainly I am a Democrat, and to that extent, I believe in the importance of government working, because I believe that our system works best when what I believe to be excesses of the private sector can be checked by government action. So I do believe in government action. But the thing I would say here, I wrote about the Senate of the late 70s as the closing years of what I called the Great Senate. But I've also emphasized the momentum of that Senate carried over to the 80s when we had a right of center Senate. We had Ronald Reagan was president. We had Senate majority shifted to the Republicans. We had Republican leaders, Howard Baker and then Bob Dole. But the Senate still functioned for the country. Bipartisan agreements were reached. The results may have been on one 40-yard line as opposed to the other 40-yard line, but the institution worked. So I think that in analyzing what happened after that, and I do have, I have some views on that, but I think that the idea of a Senate working is not necessarily a left of center idea.
Now, and this is important, especially, and it's counterintuitive, and this is why I didn't pick up a copy of the last Great Senate, but I want to read it because I was born in 1992. Much of this audience is younger, so on 15 different levels, I can't quite identify with the dynamics you're describing. But what's interesting is, like you said, this is about the late 70s. From what I've read, the 70s are a disaster. Vietnam, yeah. Watergate. The hangover from the 1960s, stagflation, Iran, all these different issues. Just tell us this counterintuitive story of how we should think of the 70s counterintuitively, like from this vantage point, as the height of the Senate.
Well, I would say it was the 60s and the 70s. Somebody said, well, what was the period of the last great Senate? Well, not to be too precise, it was 18 years from 1962 election to the 1980 election. That was it. And I chose to write about the closing years precisely because they were so interesting as you've described it. Here, the country had enormous challenges, even post-Vietnam and post-Watergate. Jimmy Carter was a well-intentioned president, and he's getting some historical reevaluation now, but the conventional wisdom is he was not a successful president. I think that's wrong in certain respects. But what I wrote about showed that Carter and the Senate accomplished a great deal in those four difficult years. The new energy policy, saving New York City and from financial ruin and Chrysler, the Alaska Lands Act. And if you go through the things that they accomplished, you come away saying, yeah, that was a pretty good Senate. The Senate and the President and the House accomplished a great deal. So one of the things that I think is important and something we've lost now, government has to work. I mean, it can't work just when one or two people decide, okay, we'll let it work for a while. It has to work year in and year out. And what you see in the last so-called last great Senate is a Senate that stepped up to work and accomplished things month after month, which is kind of remarkable. I mean, they did an energy policy at the same time they passed these terribly controversial Panama Canal treaties. And by the way, they stopped by to save New York City from financial ruin. So they were doing things all the time. Now, you might say, as some people have said to me, well, that was a Senate with like 100 or 99 white guys. And what do you think about that? That's kind of a strange thing. And I have to say that I love the fact that the Senate is more diverse now and has almost, I think, a quarter of the Senate is women. But the truth is, it's not a very good Senate, right? I mean, despite, and the women will tell us, they collaborate very effectively. Well, what's the evidence of that as it affects the overall Senate?
What I really like what you just said, and because I think we're trying to get to, once again, as we were talking about before, like this, how can we bring this bipartisan audience together? It's this idea that the Senate, let me just start this over. What I'm really saying is, what I appreciate what you're saying is, the metric for success in a Senate functioning is not insert center left to progressive policy passing. That's something which obviously someone on the right would be opposed to. Like the metric is, like you said, in the 70s, there were all these problems. Some were crises, some were longer term, some were medium term, and just day in and day out, week to week, month to month, they were just addressed. And it seems like right now, because I was going to ask you what determines when the Senate can function today, unless it's the start of the COVID pandemic and there's a need to aggressively and quickly pass something, that will happen. Or when there's this moment of the Republicans have won in 2017, so they want to pass tax cuts, they're just going to go for it. But that is not what consistent working looks like, because almost anyone, left, right, and center, could say there are all these different issues that week in, week out should be addressed, but just clearly are not addressed. And that goes in both directions. So do you just have any reflection? Because that's my main takeaway from what you're saying.
Look, there are some people who would even say, well, the Senate still working. You're focusing on some issues, but not others. There are still things that are going on. But if you measure, and I don't have the numbers at hand, but if you study the numbers, what you see is many fewer laws being passed, many more cloture motions to cut off, I mean, to try to stop filibusters or overcome the threat of filibusters. And that has gone up very sharply. Now, some would say, well, we don't favor government activity, and therefore that's a good thing. But, you know, I don't think that's a good thing from left of center or right of center. I think it's a good thing for people who oppose all forms of government activity, I suppose. But I don't think it works very well for the country. And you know, if you look at where we are on longstanding, a range of longstanding problems, you don't find, well, gee, we're not doing anything this month. You find we're not doing anything for years or decades. I mean, look, it's been, there's another, they're all controversial issues, I suppose, but the Buffalo shootings and the other shootings, horrific killings are on people's minds at the moment. 9 years ago, Sandy Hook, you know, 20 or so children, 5 or 6 year old children were killed. Conservative senators, conservative Democrat Joe Manchin, conservative Republican Pat Toomey came forward with a reasonable background check bill. You would have thought that was kind of a reasonable response that people could come together on, but they couldn't do it. That was 9 years ago. And how many, you know, so the failure, I mean, in New Zealand, they had one mass killing and 2 weeks later they had legislation, but we're not New Zealand, I understand. But the failure of government to work over long periods of time leads you in the situation we are in now. And by the way, I always emphasize, because I think never focus on much of anything besides Donald Trump. I think our political system and our system of government were in a terrible state before Donald Trump came down the escalator. I mean, one could argue that his success was based in part on the failure of government before, which I think is true. But I just want to emphasize this is a long-standing failure. It's not just Donald Trump or the Trump years.
And this is interesting because I want to push you on another thing here, which is that I'm curious how you think, whether you think the issue is the Senate as an institution or body of senators or American society. Because, for example, here's my basic standard here. So, for example, you said New Zealand, gun reform, very, very quickly. Audience members, put aside your specific beliefs on how they should approach the post-Christchurch period. Australia quickly passes a law there. But from my perspective, that's because Australian and New Zealand society actually did have a pretty strong consensus outside of legislative bodies about what the policy should look like. In this country, especially on cultural related issues, it doesn't seem like there is as much consensus. And from my perspective, it seems hard to see a world where you could have senators able to aggressively govern without that societal consensus. So how do you just think about that for me?
I think you've focused, not surprisingly, on a central question. And I guess my answer is, we're clearly a different kind of society and a much more contentious society than that consensus-based society they may have in New Zealand, where there are 10 sheep for every person, and Australia. But to me, that means that that's the job of the members of Congress and the Senate to try to bridge those differences, not simply reflect them, and certainly not exacerbate them. I think, and that to some extent, when we get to my book, that's the essence of my book is the senators, particularly, they have a responsibility to try to reach common ground. And interestingly, and I do think that the public over time, if you look at the polls back in the 70s and even in the 80s, the polls indicated they sort of thought Congress was doing pretty well. And they thought Congress was doing pretty well when it was doing pretty well. By the same token, they think this Congress has not been done well, or the recent Congresses. And they, in part, they're reflecting the fact that it hasn't. And in part, the senators fall all over themselves telling you how broken the place is. So my critique, by the way, is instead of talking about it, why don't you fix it? But, you know, it's so I guess I think that the responsibility of elected officials, and particularly those with the prestigious position of being senators, is to overcome or do their best to overcome. And the one thing I'll add on this, Marshall, and I think it's very important. I've done legislation and I've studied. I was in the Senate 12 years as a staffer. I did a lot of different things. And I've watched a lot of it. I think it's very difficult to legislate, but the essence, the baseline requirement is good faith engagement in the process. If you engage in the process and you're exchanging views with people with diverse views, something can come out of it. It's not that easy, but it comes out of it. But if you don't engage, if you're not a good faith player, then you're going to get no result. And that's where we've been for a long time. With the exception, I would say, I think the CARES Act was an exception. We had this enormous, unprecedented pandemic and, you know, and a need for a large governmental response, which we got, particularly in the first instance. But generally, that's not the way it's worked.
I actually really agree with your articulation of what the role of a senator would be. What's interesting, though, if you look at senators' revealed preferences, many folks will say, oh, the Senate's broken. It's not really functional. But I also know by, once again, just looking at behavior, not just pure articulation, that a lot of senators and people who are running for Senate, let's say right now, definitely don't agree with your conception of what a senator should be doing in terms of bridging and forging consensus. So I'm just curious, like, how would you, and I'm obviously putting words in different people's mouths here, but how would you say the, so when you say, okay, but let me ask this in a direct way then. When you say senators talk about their institution is broken, what are they saying is broken from their perspective?
Usually, and this was Democrats and Republicans and former senators commenting on the institution in recent years, usually what they meant by broken was, we're not getting anything done. We're not legislating. We're not following regular order. The leaders go off into another room and sometimes they reach agreement, but not usually. So we're not doing regular legislation. And we're living with this incredible amount of obstruction. Now, I have said to them, even in my first book, I said, well, you know, this, you ought to change it. I don't think the Senate rules work very well. When I wake up and read the newspaper and find that Rand Paul is holding up aid to Ukraine, or, you know, somebody on the left is holding up X or Y, my question has been, why should one senator be able to do that? Yeah, I would guarantee the senator a right to speak, but I wouldn't guarantee the senator a right to paralyze the place. So that has to do with the fact that we haven't looked comprehensively at the Senate rules since 1979. That's 13 years before you were born. I mean, at a certain point, you say, well, this isn't working. Why don't we try to figure out why it's not working, what we should do? I'm not saying the rules are everything. I don't think the rules are everything, but I do think they don't work. I think what the fundamental problem is we have senators who don't understand what it is to be a senator in terms of their responsibility. And we've had a Senate leader, particularly one leader, who hasn't functioned in the way that Senate leaders have traditionally functioned.
This is interesting because the side of me that really, you know, enjoyed Robert Caro's Lyndon Johnson books is just coming to mind. When you describe senators are not functioning the way that senators have functioned. And I think what's interesting here is it seems like there's this gap between ideal, or let's say even design, and just the way that people are actually behaving in a constructed manner. So I guess the thing is, let me just put it this way, pretend I'm just a ultra ambitious senator. I'm a Republican in this scenario. I hear what you're saying. And I just basically say, okay, so people 80 years ago thought that a senator's job is to do X, Y, and Z. I think a senator's job is to do A, B, and C. So I'm going to behave accordingly. Because that's what's happening. You know, if there's one thing we could take away from the Trump years, it's that, you know, and I think norms are important, but just basically saying, but everyone, like, return to the norms isn't like an effective rhetorical tact. So I'm just curious how, because I think if we're getting to what the founding fathers did effectively was thinking about these human interpersonal structural dynamics. Like, how do you think about the structural dynamic of a senator just being able to say, well, committee chairmen aren't as powerful as they used to be. Actually, it turns out that I'm not going to be electorally rewarded for performing as a good senator. How do we think about this, like, weirdly toxic mix?
I don't think we know how they would be rewarded for performing as a senator. I think it's quite possible they'd be rewarded positively if they performed and it was perceived that they were performing successfully. So I think that is a possibility. But, you know, the notion that if you're a senator, your main goal is to basically, number one, the current notion, A, to use the Senate for your own personal agenda. It's your platform. And B, your principal goal is only to get reelected. I don't believe that. And I also actually believe that most senators think that they certainly want to be reelected, and they certainly have agendas, but some of them recognize the need for collective action. And in that sense, I am a Democrat. I believe that more people on the Democratic side have felt that way. And there is a group of Republicans who understand the need for collective action, but it's much smaller. Many of those at this point reflect sort of a long movement of the Republican Party, I think.
I want to put aside for a second the personal incentives, like to, you know, get elected and to get power, because it's not that they're very legitimate, they're very real, but they're a little less interesting to me. The part that's interesting to me, and this happens with talking with actual Republicans who are staffers, people who are running for office, an example of what you're talking about is they will basically say things like, you know what, it's true. Like Mitch McConnell is cynical. He can be a bad faith actor. The way he's handled judicial appointments has not been, I think, what one would argue is the norm in American history. But guess what? Like our political movement's actual job and our base demands that we overturn Roe v. Wade. So what, and so given those stakes, like let's say you're a pro-life person, it seems to me the real conundrum is that if the choice is following tradition and norms versus achieving your big political goals, it seems to me that it's hard to find a convincing argument. And look, let's be fair. I think if there were an opportunity to pass like sweeping climate legislation, I don't think there's a guarantee that, you know, let's say leader AOC would not be as aggressive and norms busting as Mitch McConnell has. So how do you just think about the serious argument about when the stakes are high, one should do what needs to be done, which is what Mitch McConnell could turn and tell any Republican his leadership has achieved.
The norms are fundamentally important because basically politics is hard. It is a hard game, but it's not war. Mm-hmm. It actually should be constrained by certain norms and customs. If you don't have those norms and customs, the system breaks down in a way that threatens democracy. In 2017, I was moved to think more about these questions by Donald Trump's election. But in 2017, Professors Ziblatt and Levitsky wrote How Democracies Die. And that book, they point out, a constitution and laws is not enough for democracy. You actually need two other things: mutual toleration, which is breaking down, and forbearance. What do we mean by forbearance? It means you don't do everything within your power that isn't criminally illegal or criminally a violation of the law. Forbearance. You consider Garland's nomination, or you don't ram Amy Coney Barrett's through in the closing weeks. No matter what the justification is, you know, it's the old question of ends versus means. You know, some people would say if the ends are important, you do whatever you can. I don't think that's true, actually. I think it's a formula for a breakdown of the society.
It's really interesting because, and this isn't a contradiction, this is more me just like imposing what you're saying on like, let's say your book jacket. What you're really describing when you talk about forbearance are just stakes. Like the American political system cannot function if partisanship feels existential, is my perspective. Because if things are existential, then right, there literally cannot be, there cannot be rules. If it's warfare, well, I mean, obviously there are rules in warfare, but like at a big picture level, you're not going to talk about norms if your life is in question. But you're talking about here about Donald Trump being a threat to democracy. So I was taking this from the, you know, I was basically splaining for right wingers. you know, I was at a dinner with a bunch of left-leaning people. And for them, this question of Donald Trump is an existential one. Why should they follow norms, right? So you basically, do you kind of what I mean? If it's, it just seems like there's like, and obviously like—
Well, it's very hard when—
Yeah.
It's very hard to make the case. And if you're Chuck Schumer, you probably live with this. Very hard to make the case that we'll follow certain norms if the other side isn't. You know, that's kind of the race to the bottom. I mean, that gets into historical stuff as to whether this situation is symmetrical or asymmetrical, which party has changed more, things like that. I think it's an important point, and I think the evidence is pretty clear. But my goal in some of the things I've written in the book, but also in articles, I've tried to encourage the more moderate or more independent-minded Republicans, you know, to come to join with Democrats on certain things, because I believe there actually is a reasonable possibility of a consensus on certain things 55-60% of the country might actually agree on. I don't, but if you're trying to come up with something that everyone's going to agree on, you're not likely to find it. There are times in my new book, I point out times that Senator McConnell told other senators, you know, you need 60 votes. You need 70 votes. Chuck Grassley came to him and said, I've got 75 votes for criminal justice reform. And McConnell still didn't want to move it. So, you know, that's a different political approach. I think you have to look for ways to allow consensus to emerge.
You know, we've focused a lot on individual senators and Mitch McConnell and, you know, Donald Trump as culprits here. But I want to do a little audience advocacy. Just bring up a couple examples that would probably just come to mind.
Sure.
As just, and we'll just like run through these. Go for as long as you want. So one would just be actually the problem with the system is the political parties. You know, the political parties themselves are bad and they're hyper-partisan. And that is just like the central. And this is what brings to mind, you know, someone like Andrew Yang saying like, we need like more third party. Like how do you think about that response, the issue of the parties themselves and not the individuals specifically operating within those parties?
No, I think, look, I may be guilty of taking the simple, not the simple, but the easy way out by focusing on something I really know, like the Senate. I happen to think there's a good argument that we should have more political parties and that having more political parties might lead to people finding more consensus, need to compromise, less of a winner-take-all situation. The challenge of getting from a two-party system to a multi-party system is very significant. And I think what we saw, and at the presidential level, somebody's always flirting with a third party, you know, run. And when they look at the practicality of it, they figure it's not going to work out. Ross Perot ran a very successful third party run and he got 19% of the vote, which was a lot. I'm sure former President Trump looked at running as a third party person at one time or an independent and realized he was better off trying to capture the Republican Party. So there are, you know, what the ideal might be somewhat different, but the fact is we've had a two-party system for a long time and it gave us stability for a long time. But that was when the game was played more between the 40-yard lines or the 30-yard lines, not 100 yards apart.
And, you know, it's interesting. This isn't my particular take. I've just read this and it's counterintuitive, but it just makes sense to me. If you just look at a critical difference between the 70s period and today, counterintuitively, the parties are actually much weaker than they were at a very literal level, in the sense that, you know, the Republican Party did not even have a party platform during the 2020 convention. And, you know, if we're talking about what are these forces that could tamp down on an individual senator's incentive to make it about themselves or not follow the rules or not care about those broader consensus things, it's actually the weakening of any like broader stricture actually like impacting them. So I think that's an interesting bit there. Another question would be just money in politics. And just like the aspect of fundraising, like there's that, like, you know, you're spending 7 hours a day on the phone. How do you think about the money in politics argument when it comes to the Senate's dysfunction?
I think it's an important part of it. I think it's far too much time spent raising money and, frankly, far too much influence by big money. The one thing I will say for the system, I guess the thing that surprised me pleasantly, is there the emergence of small donors on both sides. I think that's been positive. If you had told me that Bernie Sanders could raise, you know, get a million people to give him $27 each, I wouldn't have known that. And so I think that that's healthy. And the other, both sides have tried to develop a small donor base. And at the same time, both sides have gone heavily into large money. The only good thing about it is that both parties have enough money to fiercely contest these elections.
I love the way you set that up, because I think it gets at what my position is, which is this is a factor, but it's not an explanatory factor. So for example, the way I explain this to people is, think about it this way. Michael Bloomberg could spend as much money as he wants on gun control advocacy, and it's not going to advance that. And he actually has. He spent billions of dollars since 2013 and trying to advance the sort of reforms you're describing. If money, expenditure, capture were the pure, and once again, like, this isn't dunking on gun control people, but it's just the fact that, like, it actually doesn't explain the issue that it seems to be we're getting to at a core of. So it's a factor, it's a dynamic, but it actually doesn't explain all of it. And I think there's a lot of interesting examples like that. And I also just appreciate your point that, you know, when you add in just like the small dollars, it seems like we're probably just at this weird equilibrium state where, you know, Bernie can have a real national campaign, and at the same time, you know, Michael Bloomberg could get two delegates from Guam while spending $1 billion. So I'm not saying this is positive, but it's just basic. And then, you know, the third and last one is just the most obvious one for a younger audience, just age. You know, the Senate is full of old people and they like the status quo and they don't want to change. And the solution is to elect younger people. I think a quick editorial that I'll add to this before I get your perspective is, I do not see how folks can look at Madison Cawthorn, Elise Stefanik, and let's even say AOC to like both sides it for a second, because I think she's not been a particularly effective legislator in the House, and think that just electing younger people is a palliative in any category. I'm curious how you think about it.
I can point to a lot of members who are old, who are still effective and contributing something, without a doubt. I mean, our leader, I certainly actually don't think Nancy Pelosi is 80 and she's still very effective. I think McConnell's 80 and he's very effective, although I don't
agree he's the most effective person in American politics right now.
Yes, I think that's what I've said in my book, and I think that's true. And I think the president's effective and he's old. You know, so, but I do think that at a certain point, that generation, the generation I'm kind of identified with because I'm old too, need to pass the torch to people. The next generation, and there's some very promising people that you can find in the Senate and the House who are terrific legislators, terrific politicians. It's time to pass the torch to them. And we've got extreme cases where Senator Feinstein regrettably tarnished her great career by choosing to run again at the age of 85. that wasn't a very good idea. It was not going to end up well, and it hasn't. And at the same time, Senator Grassley looks at the situation and says, you know, my takeaway is I should run again at 88. Well, that's not going to work out well either. So, you know, people have to use some good judgment. But in general, I don't, you know, so I guess I think that age is a real issue. And having an old Senate of the sort we have is not great. But I don't think that's the problem. I think that's the problem.
I think it's similar to the money and politics situation, but it's a factor that should play into one's analysis. But I think, once again, to get back to, I think the core, I would say a core takeaway from just your body of work is that there are broken dynamics. Like you said, you can, if you haven't updated the Senate rules, dumping a bunch of 35-year-olds into that situation is not going to result necessarily in a better outcome or a better functioning Senate. And I think it's important that, so I think what I'd want for folks, especially the younger audience members who just push on the age factor, to treat it as a secondary thing, but focus on the primary thing. Because at the end of the day, it's the Senate. There are going to be 60 to 80-year-old people who run the institution. That's just a generic reality. So any reform you're going to advocate for has to include that. So I want to get to your just perspective on these big reform questions. And these are definitely going to play more to the Democratic side of the audience, because that's where, because like you said, like the principal impact, I would say because of the nature of the questions facing the country right now, Senate dysfunction is more of not existential. It's more of a present issue for a Democrat than for a Republican right now. So
right,
let's talk about them. Filibuster reform. Can you just explain what the filibuster is real quick, not to get too wonky? And B, what is your perspective on the filibuster as a norm institution, those bits?
I favor abolishing the filibuster. I think that historically, you go back to the founders, Madison, Hamilton, they believed in majority rule. They only believed in supermajorities in limited specific cases.
Treaties, yeah. those specific things.
Also, though, interestingly, the filibuster grew up in a way, and the cloture, the notion of invoking cloture to cut off debate, and they'd vote majority rule. Over time, that started being abused. And they needed some way to cut off debate. So the idea of cloture, cutting off debate, which was adopted in 1917, was adopted for the purpose of cutting off debate. And first it was 2/3 of the Senate, then it was 3/5 of the Senate. But it was not supposed to be used as a tool to just continue debate indefinitely. So my take is, institutions, political institutions have to work. The Senate, U.S. Senate, is the only place in the world that has filibusters of this sort, and that works supposedly by unanimous consent, so that Rand Paul or Bernie Sanders can stop the Senate by themselves. And by the way, non-germane amendments, that is, irrelevant amendments. I think that the Senate, the legitimacy of the Senate is going to be challenged anyway. Two senators from California, as opposed to two senators from Wyoming, where California has, I think, 70 or 80 times as much the population. You overcome that only by finding ways to make the institution work. And so I favor getting rid of some of the procedural things that leads to more deadlock.
What is your response to the very tactical follow-up, which is,
what do they do?
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Democrats, you have 52 seats. I get why you want to be able to impose your priorities, but what happens when we have 48 seats? We need to preserve these minority protections or else Mitch McConnell will run roughshod over us. What's your response to that argument? Because that's the argument that seems to win out consistently.
Well, I think, first of all, we've seen that having 50 or 52 Democratic seats doesn't guarantee that they'll all vote together. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, one or two can hold things up. I think that you're still going to have to find a way to build some consensus that holds people together. I think that if the Republicans get in and they would want to do something that I would regard as extreme, they may not be able to hold their 52 people together. In a sense, you'd be acknowledging more that we had moved in the direction of a parliamentary model, right?
Interesting.
In other words...
Can you make that precise, what you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is parliamentary governments work with the assurance, the general assurance that if you take over the government, you're going to get a few years to try your program and you have a guaranteed majority. And then if you fail, you'll be voted out or there'll be a lack of confidence vote, et cetera. In our system, you know, we move toward more paralysis than anything else. So I guess the two possibilities, you're making me think about it more, but the two possibilities here, if you abolish the filibuster, one, you're still going to have a hell of a time finding the majority to get your program through. Two, if you're able to get your program through, well, then you'll live by it and then you'll stand on it when you run for re-election or not. And the other party will get their chance, if they defeat you, to get their program through. I think that's probably a better system than endless paralysis. You know, President Biden, who I admire greatly, likes to say, we're Americans, there's nothing we can't do. Well, okay, that's rhetorically good. I try to figure out what it is we've done lately. We seem to come back to having won World War II and put a man on the moon. Now, that was a long time ago. The COVID vaccines could have been something that we did, but they became divisive. But the point is, as we started out by saying, Marshall, the government has to work kind of continuously. You know, it can't work every 20, 30, 40 years.
I think the last big question to put to you, and this I think goes not against what you're saying, but I'm just like thinking about this out loud. You started by talking about checks and balances and how a critique you have of the Senate, especially during the Trump years, is that it did not serve as enough of a check on President Trump and his various ambitions and dynamics within his vision of the Republican Party. As I'm just thinking about the game theory, though, of how you actually force reform, given all these dynamics, my only conclusion is that reform could probably only come from a powerful president on the outside, in the sense that, okay, so for example, President Trump has proven one thing, is that he could basically get a huge percentage of Republican senators to effectively go along with what he believes. It seems to me that that is the only type of power that could actually enforce a status quo change, just given these dynamics. So like, let's make that less about Trump and make it more just about, can the Senate be reformed from the inside, or does it require, let's say, a president to run on a campaign of, we need to do big things again. The central problem in our society is that the Senate and our legislature does not function. I will force it to change. How do you just think about that bit?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't thought about it in quite that way yet. So I might take a few minutes to think about that more. I mean, certainly there is a question whether the Senate can change itself, given the incentives we've been discussing. It's a little hard for me to envision a president coming into office, having made the Senate and its dysfunction the biggest issue. But maybe that'll work. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a frustration to an older person to think about the world that we're sort of bequeathing to my children and my grandchildren at the moment. And the frustration I have is that we have enormous assets as a country. We have, nobody's got our assets as a country. We're being held back by dysfunctional government and a broken political system. I find that to be kind of amazing. And the reason I focused this last book on McConnell is I actually think he has been the most powerful political figure of the last, say, 13, 14 years. And this is a little bit of, I always wanted to use Occam's razor for something, right? Yeah. I mean, every now and again, the simplest answer and the most straightforward answer is the right one. We have one of the longest serving Senate leaders who's been enormously powerful, and we have a dysfunctional Senate and a dysfunctional government that's failed us. And there could be a correlation between those things.
On that optimistic, motivational.
Well, I have an optimistic ending.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
No. I mean, one of and you didn't. We didn't really talk about my book very much. We talked about bigger things. But the optimistic ending, if you follow my argument and of what's happened, is that the 2022 Senate elections are very important, and you know it's an elections actually do matter. 2018 had consequences, giving us a Democratic House. 2020 had consequences, and 2022 have consequences. So, as Joe Manchin would say, for us Democrats, if you don't like my views, elect more liberals. I think it's a good plan. But anyway, I kept my politics to the end, until the end.
Oh, Ira, this has been really great. Could you, like I said, I like Norm Ornstein just did a review of the book in the Washington Monthly today, and he just really talked about how your work starts
the
with
arc.
The last great Senate in 2012, and then in 2017 the Senate's broken, and now we're focused on these individuals. So could you shout out your three books for anyone who's like really interested in going deep into the canon?
Well, thanks. The first book was The Last Great Senate, the book came out in 2012. It's about the Senate of the late 70s as an example of how the Senate used to work. And it was nominated for a Pulitzer. I circled back 6 years later to write Broken, Can the Senate Save Itself and the Country? And that was written to cover the first year of Trump, and came out, as Norm Ornstein said, with some degree of optimism that the senators were aware of the special challenge that President Trump posed. And that was particularly true with respect to Russia and his relationship to Russia. That degree of optimism wasn't justified. And so I wrote the last book, which is The Betrayal, How Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans Abandoned America, which I think is by and large accurate. They abandoned America until the time to ram through Amy Coney Barrett's nomination came. And I thought that was a shocking act under the circumstances.
Well, Ira, this has been really great, and I genuinely, I really want to get into Last Great Senate, because I think that's a, because once again, like the juxtaposition of the 70s and just that is like very interesting. A lot of those 70s issues rhyme with today. So a lot of great stuff there. Thank you for joining us on The Realignment.
Marshall, thank you for giving, this is wonderful. Thanks for the quality of these questions and the quality of the conversation. Next time I'll better prepare.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.